It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Fatal opioid overdoses in the region dropped significantly, 43% in 2018 in the region. Is that due to law enforcement, treatment programs, naloxone? We're going to talk about all that as well as hate-related activities in the region with Bob Jones, special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. Welcome back to the Confluence, sir.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here.
So is it a multi-pronged approach that is resulting in those decreased numbers of opioid overdose fatalities?
We think so. We've developed a number of task forces over the last few years to kind of attack it from every angle. We've looked at it from a supply side, a demand side, and again, some of the things you mentioned probably also technically influence those numbers. But overall, we think that we've been a big contributor to that 43% decrease.
The task forces, are they strictly at the federal level of your office, or is it cooperation with local state law enforcement as well?
We usually lead them, but they include task force officers from multiple different departments, state, county, local, other federal.
Mm-hmm. Just how bad was it? And, you know, it's still fatal overdoses are fatal overdoses, but just how bad was it and where are we right now after 2018?
Sure. 2017 was a terrible year for us. Pennsylvania that year ranked third nationwide for fatal overdoses, opioid related. Additionally, we're surrounded by states that also had terrible overdose rates, parts of southern Ohio, Western Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and then West Virginia itself. That 43% cut into that. I think in Allegheny County last year we had 275. You know, again, a big reduction, but still just in Allegheny, Beaver, Butler, Fayette, Washington, and Westmoreland last year, our best year, we still had 596 deaths. That's far too many.
Right. Allegheny County, the Pittsburgh area, per capita, it was quite high in 17.
It was. Probably one of the highest in the country. I think it was third behind Cook County, Illinois, and then New York City.
And, of course, Cook County is Chicago.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So the drug overdose deaths. But is the real measure fewer overdoses? Because naloxone has become so available and is saving lives, so fewer people, fewer users are dying. But how do you count the overdoses themselves and people using the illegal opioids?
That's a great question. We really can't count a number of the overdoses. A lot of times they're not reported to us. And we know, again, that the numbers are affected by the ability for law enforcement and first responders to apply those antidotes that save lives. So a lot of time it's a guessing game. But again, those numbers for 2018 show us that we're doing something right.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the task force. What's the role? What's the goal?
We have three different that actually focus on this problem. Our healthcare fraud task force looks at the bad doctors, those mm-hmm. prescription writers out there that exceed by far the regular prescriptions that are written across the country. We have an opioid overdose task force where we look at each overdose and we try to work it up from that individual to the supplier above them, eventually try to trace that to the point of origin. And then we've started a darknet fentanyl working group that sort of looks at the fentanyl that's coming from the dark web, usually from China, and making its way onto the streets of the Commonwealth.
I'm going to touch upon each of those. So has law enforcement at the federal level, your level, has it pivoted to more targeting the sources of the drugs?
We try to target it at every point we can. Again, those task forces sort of show the progression of that drug and its impact on society. Started off as a prescription drug problem, generated an increased demand for opioids on the streets, heroin, which was much cheaper than the prescription drugs, and then now the fentanyl that's coming from the dark net through the mail.
You know, for decades, we've heard in the news and people who listen to the news and read the news, law enforcement would make arrests of drug dealers on the street corners and then on up the ladder to their suppliers. But that illegal drug activity online, what special challenges does the darknet pose?
We can't monitor it. You can buy anything you want from the dark web. And if there is a source out there that wants to put that type of narcotic for sale on the dark web, there's not a lot we can do about it. There are some vulnerabilities, and we shut down a number of different marketplaces. But as we see in anything economic, the bad guys will switch to a different marketplace or a different system that's new and that we can't impact as much as we have with the old ones.
If you can't monitor it, what is the task force regarding the dark web specifically doing then?
We'll look at a group that we arrest in another fashion and find that they are seeking out those particular narcotics from the dark web. We'll take over personas. We'll take over accounts. We'll work sort of back towards that marketplace and then not try to take down the individual distributor, but the marketplace itself, the entire illicit marketplace.
You mentioned fentanyl, extremely powerful synthetic opioid. Is this more difficult to detect than other opioids?
It's not necessarily more difficult to detect. It's just easier to come by than most synthetic narcotics. So you can invest a relatively small amount of money in Chinese-produced fentanyl and multiply it times 100 or 200 when you mix it in the street. Not only is it concerned because it's easier to obtain, it's just much more deadly too. A very, very small amount can cause a fatal overdose, and most users are not familiar with how small of amount is required to end a life.
And I assume most mixers of the fentanyl are not necessarily experts at mixing because they could be killing off their customers.
Correct. And it's a weird dynamic. When we see a hot bag or a hot mix, it's strange in that a lot of times the addicts want to gravitate towards that source of supply because they know it's good stuff.
Your office and the U.S. Attorney, Scott Brady, seem to be making a priority to go after, let's put it bluntly, other drug dealers, medical professionals. What's your approach here? People who are illegally prescribing legal prescriptions.
We're looking at all those angles. We've seen the problem sort of gravitate away from the bad script writers, but we know that they're still out there, and we're still making a concentrated effort to put those doctors in jail where they belong. An additional focus that most people don't know about is now we're seeing fraud in the addict recovery area, where a young person knows that they have a problem, or an old person, they go to seek professional help for that, and they're defrauded. That particularly upsets me, and again, we're focusing additional resources there.
They're defrauded because treatment centers or whomever supposedly providing the treatment is...
Correct. They're having prescriptions written for recovery narcotics. They're not getting the counseling that they should be receiving with this treatment. It's mostly bogus, and again, we want to dedicate additional resources towards that.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Bob Jones. He's the FBI special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office. As you know, late 2018 and earlier this year, there were reports of hate-based activities from nationalist flyers distributed in the South Hills to flyers in Squirrel Hill advertising a KKK chapter to a swastika painted on a building in Lawrenceville. Can you give us an idea of the overall level of hate-based activities in the region? And I know your region covers a big distance of western Pennsylvania and into West Virginia, doesn't it?
It does. We have all of West Virginia and 23 counties in western Pennsylvania. Luckily, I think we're fairly in good shape in that although in 2017 we saw national rates at a 17% increase, and then in Pennsylvania itself, 28% increase. But in the local area, in Southwest PA specifically, we've been very fortunate that there have been relatively few numbers of incidents.
When someone reports such an incident that I mentioned, is it a matter for local authorities, or does the FBI step in right away? What is your role?
We do significant outreach with the communities and with the local authorities. Our role would be obviously to prosecute if we can show intent. That's very difficult to do. We'd like local authorities, if they find out information from communities, to get that to us so we can sort of see if it's trending nationally.
So intent is the big thing, even if it's a swastika painted on a building?
Sure. Unfortunately, much of this hate speech or hate paraphernalia that you may see is First Amendment. As heinous as it sounds, it's protected by the First Amendment, freedom of speech. So, again, to move from a freedom of speech protected activity to a crime, we have to show intent, and that's difficult to do.
Is it a two-way street, you and the public, in the sense of, you know, you're looking for help, whether it's tips of hate-related activity, but also you're going out in the community to talk to them about?
We do. We go out a lot. In fact, I went to an event in Lawrenceville where we met with those community members, and we try to educate them to what they should do. A lot of times, graffiti, hate-based graffiti, is painted over or whitewashed over or removed somehow. We want to educate the community to take pictures of it, make sure they document it, what they've seen before that happens, get us to the scene so we can take a look at it so we could identify trends if we see them.
Okay. And so you talk about that, but you also rely on tips. I mean, explain to us, can you monitor versus follow up on tips?
Sure. Most of the things that you see on social media are not something that we can monitor. And we depend on the public to tell us if they see hurtful communications or something that may cross the line into an actual threat that's initially protected by the First Amendment.
What are you taking away from these community meetings? What's the response of the community been toward you?
We see great response. Again, I went to the Lawrenceville meeting, very receptive to what we had to tell them, and they seemed like they were true partners with us in making sure that everybody understood that this kind of conversation wouldn't be tolerated in the community, and that there were a significant they had responsibility to help us stop it, and they seemed ready to take that responsibility.
We have only about 30 seconds left or so. As the leader of the FBI office here in Pittsburgh, what's your biggest concern? The known groups that we all have heard their names and all that, or the lone wolves?
I am particularly concerned about the lone wolves. They're just much more difficult to find and much more difficult to stop since they talk with not too many people, and sometimes we don't figure out what they're up to until they actually do something.
And the talking is on sites that maybe the normal person wouldn't be on.
That's correct.
Bob Jones is the special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Governor Tom Wolf wants to more than double the minimum pay a teacher can earn in Pennsylvania. A group of Afghan refugees recently resettled in Pittsburgh are celebrating the beauty of Afghan culture through theatrical portraits. Actors will tell their stories while the women gain experience cooking Afghan dishes together for the audience in service of their central goal to open the first Afghan food business in Pittsburgh. And the Pennsylvania Turnpike toll collection system could be fully automated by 2022, which could save money, but at the cost of hundreds of jobs. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, a Waco 9 airplane called Miss Pittsburgh makes the first airmail flight in the region from Bettisfield near McKeesport to Cleveland in 1927. The plane was soon joined by two others of its design, Miss Youngstown and Miss McKeesport. They carried a payload of 800 pounds and could hit a maximum speed of 92 miles per hour. As technology advanced, Miss Pittsburgh retired and was featured in commercials in the 1960s. Then, in the 90s, airplane enthusiasts in Pittsburgh raised enough money to have the plane returned to the city. It's now above the main TSA checkpoint at Pittsburgh International Airport. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh businessman Greg Spencer of Oakland says he may be nearing retirement as the owner of chemical company Randall Industries. But Spencer tells 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort that he'll never retire from mentoring the young people seeking his guidance and advice.
You've mentored young African-American boys and men over 30 years. Why do you carve out time to mentor?
I came from a humble background. I was blessed to become successful, and it is an effective way of giving back. I actually think that's my purpose. And when you think about how to identify your purpose, It comes to what do you enjoy doing, what are you good at, and how do other people observe you in that role? And so I recently came to that conclusion. My purpose is to mentor young men primarily, although I have mentored women as well. And I've been pretty successful at it.
Now, how do you measure success?
The beauty of mentoring is watching someone grow. What I've loved to observe is when I'm mentoring with a young person, after spending time and answering questions they have and their reaction to it, then I felt I've been successful.
When you say that you've been successful at this, that in turn means that the young people you mentor end up being successful.
Yes, and they are the ones that they would define that they are now successful. So they're corporate executives, tradesmen, people that struggle every day to make a difference in their own lives and their family lives. So it's a range, and so it's how they define success. I have three mentees graduating this year, one with his PhD, and he was homeless when I met him. And the other, his mother passed away when he was in high school of cancer, and he graduated from Imani Christian Academy. I was on the board at that time, and he's graduating from Duquesne next month. And then third, just recently graduated from W&J and is now going on to get his master's.
What is it that you say to young people in these pretty challenging situations?
It's listening. As you listen, you'll hear what's on their mind, they'll share with you, and then you can give them a little insight. I used to tell them, there's nothing you've done that I haven't done or been involved in. So don't worry about telling me something that will embarrass you. It won't embarrass me.
That you couldn't possibly stop.
No, I could not stop. As long as I'm adding value, and I mentioned I felt called to do this, there will always be someone that's looking for advice, and I offer that. So I don't see me being able to stop.
Greg Spencer, thank you for making time to do this interview.
Thank you for asking me.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. $18,500 a year. That's the minimum salary a teacher can earn in Pennsylvania, according to state law. Governor Tom Wolf wants to set a new baseline at $45,000. For Keystone Crossroads, Jen Kinney visited one of the lowest-paying school districts in the state.
Jody Gary has been teaching math and science in the Turkey Foot Area School District for 27 years. It's a rural district in southwestern Pennsylvania, in an area known for bicycling and scenic views.
It's a wonderful place to be if you love the outdoors. I love to hike, backpack, and camp.
The biggest town around here is Confluence, population 834. The district covers 100 square miles, but has just one school, 321 students, all in one building. When Gary was first hired, his salary was $18,500.
With college loans and living expenses, it was a struggle at first.
But Gary stuck with the district. His salary has gone up over time, but the district remains one of the lowest paying in the state. It's one of five where teachers average less than the governor's proposed new minimum of $45,000. Starting salaries here can be less than half of that. So if Wolf's plan is adopted,
our teachers would jump up and down. We have some teachers with close to 15 years experience that probably are not at $45,000.
Talk to parents around the district, and they're well aware that low pay is an issue. Amy Wilt is a parent I met at her kid's softball game.
I think it would be great that we'd raise the salaries in Pennsylvania for all the teachers.
Sandy Yunkin owns a bed and breakfast in town.
I do not believe that a $22,000 starting salary is fair for someone who's in charge of educating your children.
On average, classroom teachers in Pennsylvania make around $67,000 a year. If the governor's proposal went into effect, over 3,000 teachers around the state would see their paychecks go up, many in rural districts like this one. Gary says the low pay also makes it hard for the district to hire and retain qualified educators.
We probably lost 8 to 10 teachers to neighboring schools. And when you talk to them, the majority, not all, but the majority of them left because of money.
Superintendent Jeffrey Malaspino agrees. He's had trouble getting a local college to push graduates to even consider positions at the district.
Told me that all of their graduates were leaving Pennsylvania, going out of state. Because there are just a ton of opportunities and salaries are higher than Pennsylvania's.
Governor Wolf's plan would cost the state around $14 million. And he says it wouldn't cost districts an extra dime. Critics say the proposal would have a cascade effect, boosting salaries at the top end, with those costs falling to local taxpayers. Other critics have a different concern. Donna Cooper of the nonprofit Public Citizens for Children and Youth says the plan wouldn't send money to districts that need it the most.
In some cases, we're sending that money to communities that have chosen to underspend on their kids and be low-tax communities.
A Keystone Crossroads analysis shows that many of the biggest winners under Wolf's plan already have an advantage under a state education funding scheme that tends to benefit shrinking rural districts.
It creates a set of perverse incentives for districts to make decisions that are not in the interest of their students and expect that the state will come bail them out when they need to bring their teachers' salaries up to a reasonable level.
Cooper says instead of distributing the money according to current teacher salaries, it should be tied to student needs through the state's fair funding formula. That way, instead of turkey foot, the big winners would be districts like York and Allentown. Those districts are also poor, but residents pay higher taxes and there's deeper student needs. And there's yet another critique of Wolf's plan. Amy Rote is a teacher and active union member in Philadelphia.
Obviously, if you live in Beaver County compared to living in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, the cost of living is quite different.
A plan that would truly help the state's most hard-pressed teachers would need to take cost of living into effect. Wolf's doesn't, and thus Philadelphia, Harrisburg, and Allentown get nothing.
I think the state legislature should go back to the drawing board, and they should figure out how we can do this fairly and transparently and make a permanent fix, because in a couple years, $45,000 isn't going to be the answer either.
Wolf's plan is backed by PSEA, the state's largest teachers union, and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have sponsored bills to implement it. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Jen Kinney.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Some very unusual theatrical presentations are taking place in Pittsburgh. These live cultural events were created by artist Molly Rice and her company Real Time Interventions, done in collaboration with a group of recently resettled Afghan refugees. Karachi presents the real-life stories of courage and perseverance experienced by a group of women building new lives for themselves and their families. Recently, Rice, along with partner Rusty Thielen, resettlement facilitator Becky Johnson, and two of the women living this dramatic story, sat down with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker to explain this uncommonly ambitious project.
Molly Rice, I'll start with you. Everybody is here because of a unique theatrical presentation, although am I correct in calling this a theatrical presentation? This kind of defies description.
I think you're correct that it defies description. It does have theatrical elements, but it has culinary and cultural elements as well as some music.
Let's go ahead and go back to square one and How did the whole thing start? What was the first thing that happened to get the ball rolling?
Great. I was incredibly lucky to receive a commission from the Office of Public Art. This was in 2017, and it was a two-year commission. I was one of four artists, and each of us was paired with an organization that works with refugees. So I was paired with what, at the time, was Northern Area Multi-Service Center's Refugee Resettlement Agency, long name, and our task was to create a new work for and with refugees in Pittsburgh. So I started to shadow everyone in the organization, basically going on airport pickups, home visits. I learned a lot about all the paperwork and the red tape that's required, but also met a lot of refugees and started to be particularly attracted to working with the Afghan community for several reasons. And we started a sewing group to support especially the Afghan women when they come, because it's a very lonely process. Many of them don't speak the language while their husbands do, and their children are learning so fast how to speak the language. So they're sort of on their own. And of course, in Afghanistan, they spent many years very much on their own in their homes. So this was really an effort to help encourage the women, A, to learn a skill that they were interested in, which is sewing, but also to have a place to go where they could speak their own language, where they could be together.
So this provided camaraderie and an opportunity to help settle into their new lives. But when, about 9 months into the sewing group, you asked them if that's what they wanted to do, to be the focus of the project you were commissioned to do, you were surprised.
And they said, you know, we love sewing and we're glad to be learning it, but we are amazing cooks. And we've been doing it our whole lives, and we want to introduce the Pittsburgh public to Afghan food and hopefully start a food business.
And there is no presence of Afghan food in the Pittsburgh area, is there?
No, none at all. And they were aware of that. They knew that, and they said, that's the project we want to do. So that was last April. So it's really a very new project, but the goal has been to create a really wonderful artistic series of events that introduces the Pittsburgh public to Afghan food in hopes to support these women in a future business.
I'd like to take the conversation to Becky now, if I could, and just
sure.
explain a little bit about your involvement with the process, and at what point did you become involved? Were you here at Ground Zero?
Yes. So I've worked in refugee resettlement at that point for about six or so years. And I was involved starting in the application process when NAMS was looking to, you know, be one of the recipient agencies to host an artist in residence. So I was a part of that process from the beginning, which was really exciting.
And just for clarity, I'll restate that NAMS was the Northern Area Multi-Service Center. And now, were you the decision maker as to who was going to participate in the project?
No, I think it was definitely a group effort. There were some other people at NAMS who were also helping with that. But we worked really closely as well with our colleagues at the Office of Public Art to kind of decide based on, you know, the various artists' skills who might be a good fit for what we were looking to do. For a refugee resettlement agency, this was really new to work with an artist to showcase something special about the population you're working to serve. And that was really exciting for us. And the open-endedness of it was really exciting to see where this could go to represent the populations that we're trying so hard to represent ourselves.
It seems like a good time to turn the conversation to one of our new arrivals, and I've been asked to use just first names. So, Matsura, I will ask you, you're involved in a project where your story is being presented by actors on stage, and you'll be cooking, and you're hoping that ultimately you'll be able to open up a restaurant at the end of this. I'll ask you how you feel about the way things are going so far.
We are working in a project with Mali Rice, and I'm so happy, and I hope we can continue our business, and we have a good future with our business.
I think an important question to ask you, too, is what do you think about Pittsburgh? How do you feel about Pittsburgh?
It's good. I love Pittsburgh, and I'm happy here. Yeah. At the first, it was a little difficult because when we arrive, we don't have any family, and we don't know any friends. But now there are many Afghan people, and also we are having our American friends, and they are good with us, and now I'm happy. Yes.
And Haida, I'd like to ask for your thoughts.
I'm very, very happy because we find this opportunity to work and to represent ourselves, our culture, our country, and the nice part of our country, the nice part of our culture. And everything that the media doesn't show for people, we all know that, we all see that the media just show the war part, the worst part of the Afghanistan, and they don't show the nice part, the goodness that real Afghanistan is.
I can only imagine how important it must be to you to be able to explain your culture and your homeland in a way that the media typically doesn't. Thank you, both of you. Rusty Thielen, I'll turn the conversation to you. You serve as the director and the producer of these presentations. You're a partner with Molly Rice in Real Time Interventions. Could you explain a little bit about how you fleshed out the details about how the presentation would take place?
We knew that the women might be a little shy about telling their own stories, so that early on became a discussion. How do we best present these stories? And the fact that they actually want to cook each night for an audience. So they were gracious enough to say, we will cook for the audience. We'll let you use our stories. We don't want to tell the stories ourselves. So Real Time proposed bringing in professional actors. And one of the really cool, interesting parts of the process is that the women sat in on all the auditions, and they actually picked their own actors. We narrowed down, some of Pittsburgh's finest came in, to audition for this part, and we weeded it down to 15 actors, and then the women picked the actors that they wanted to represent them. So that was a really interesting process, and we think we did a really good job with the cast on this.
And Rusty, the physical aspects of the presentations, the productions, the lighting, the tables, the chairs.
Sure. It was very important to us to sort of give the audience a feel for what it might be like to visit the women in their homes. It looks at the beginning like a lecture plus, like the audience will come in and Becky and Molly will sort of give some guidelines for how the evening will go and everybody will be together as a group. But then once that section is done, and that'll only be a few minutes, then the audience will divide actually into groups of about 10 people each. And each of those groups will go to a different area in the performance space where they will be welcomed into the home of the performer who's portraying the ladies, who will introduce themselves and say, tonight, Haida has asked me to represent her. And then they will spend about 10 minutes in each room learning about that woman and tasting the food. The food will roll out with each room. After 10 minutes, then that group will move to another room. We call them rooms, but it'll be one big space. And then at the end of the whole evening, everybody will come together for a final few words. And then the audience will get an opportunity to go back to their initial rooms and meet the actual women who have made the food for them that night. They'll come out, their families will be there, their kids will be there. And there'll be a few minutes for the audience to get to know the women personally.
And Haida and Matsura, I can't begin to imagine how you must feel as you look forward to people meeting you in such a unique way. Haida, your thoughts?
I just want to see that moment, how they feel when they see me and my family.
And Matsura?
Yes, I'm also excited about that night, and I'm so excited, and I'm thinking about that, if we can represent our food to people, and they heard our story, what they're feeling about us and about our country.
Thank you. And the name of the presentation, Karaki with a K, could you first check my pronunciation and then tell me what it means, why you chose it?
I think it's Khuraki.
Yes, it's Khuraki.
Khuraki.
I've been practicing.
Thank you. And why you chose it, what it means?
Yes, well, from what I understand, I'm sure I'm not getting the full meaning, but it means anything related to eating or meal. So it's a pretty broad term. I thought it might cover a lot of the different kind of nourishment that we hope to give. And I think what something Haida said was really important, which is that she's looking forward to the moment when people see her. Because, just to remember that in Afghanistan, there was a time where women really were not seen. And that was the true inspiration for this project. So that's what I'm looking forward to also.
Haida?
And it's good for us to show for people that we are not Haida anymore. We are not like disappear. We are not nothing. We are something. We are human.
Yeah.
Yes. We have right to speak. We have right to
do something.
To be not hide.
Thank you, Hada. Yeah. Molly Rice, Becky Johnson, Rusty Thielen, Matsura, and Hada. And again, I've been asked to use first names here. Thank you all for coming in to talk about these hard-to-categorize theatrical events, which will feature actors portraying women from Afghanistan newly arrived in Pittsburgh. The preparation and sharing of food will be central to these presentations, and the women are hoping that ultimately it'll lead to them being able to open up a restaurant. For The Confluence, I'm Bob Studebaker.
Tickets for these events were very limited and are no longer available, but they do have a waiting list, and if you'd like to sign up, there's a chance you could get in. Email them at realtimeinterventions@gmail.com. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It could save tens of millions of dollars annually, but it also could cost hundreds of jobs. The Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission is transitioning to an all-electronic tolling system. Joining us now is WESA's Margaret J. Krause, who reports on transportation and development. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Kevin.
All right. So this is nothing new. The Turnpike Commission's been considering this for years, right?
Yes. So they first approved a feasibility study in 2010, which got rolling in 2011. So it's been cooking away for years.
Okay. Has there been a holdup, or has this been sort of this slow, steady progress all along?
Slow, steady progress for a number of reasons. One, and also some roadblocks, as you say, no pun intended, or maybe intended, can't tell. They know that they have a lot of employees that they don't want to suddenly put out of a job. They say they've been very careful about talking about transition and future careers and assistance for pursuing future careers. But it also took them until 2016 to find a third-party collector to help enable this transition.
All right. How many jobs are we talking about, whether they're through attrition or layoff?
So there's about 500 toll collectors still employed by the state of Pennsylvania.
How much could it save, and how badly does the commission need the money?
Oh, well, it could save about $70 million a year, the Turnpike Commission CEO Mark Compton told me. And they need the money. The Turnpike is one of the most heavily leveraged bodies in the state of Pennsylvania, maybe even nationwide by Compton's estimates. They are about $11 billion in debt. And part of it is thanks to the screwy agreement that the legislature approved in 2007 and amended in 2013.
And this is the funding for PennDOT, roads, yes, bridges, and also mass transit.
So each year, the Turnpike Commission floats a bond, and they give $450 million to PennDOT. And PennDOT uses that money to then send on to mass transit authorities like Port Authority here in this part of the state, SEPTA in the eastern part of the state, and mass transit authorities across Pennsylvania. And it also goes to other transportation initiatives as well through PennDOT.
All right. So, but those annual toll hikes that we've been experiencing, that hasn't knocked away that debt, has it?
No. It's been an 11-year streak of increases, but it doesn't, it can't really touch that debt. $11 billion is just, there's, I don't know how many exactly drivers you would need on the turnpike to have you make that enough money.
Okay. So how would it work? Everybody have to get Easy Pass or what?
No. So you can use Easy Pass, but they are installing what's called toll by plate. So you roll through, you don't have Easy Pass, you don't have to go to the cash lane. You just keep on driving. A camera takes a picture of your license plate, you get a bill in the mail.
How efficient is that? How are they going to enforce those bills, especially for out-of-state motorists?
Right. So that's what remains to be seen. In Pennsylvania, at some point, if you're a Pennsylvanian, you can have your vehicle registration suspended when you hit that $500 mark or six missed tolls or fees. But while the state of Pennsylvania has the ability to write reciprocal agreements, i.e. Ohio, Virginia, right, to come after people, those aren't written yet.
And the deadline is 2022?
They are aiming for a 2022 deadline.
All right. Margaret J. Krause covers transportation and development for WESA. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
For today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police has put the majority of its policies online, including its code of ethics, use of force, and rules on police-involved shootings. Police Chief Scott Schubert joins us tomorrow. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Mick Stinelli and Julia Zankovic. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.
This is the sound of a free press.
Those families are now at a crossroads.
Free to explore.
Is it a problem that the Afghan government is not involved in these talks?
Free to challenge.
NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell is in our studios this morning. Hi, Kelsey.
Hey there.
90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR news station. The sound of a free press.
I'm Sarah Kovash, digital engagement editor of Pittsburgh's NPR news station. Start your day with meaningful news.